From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. A new campaign asks Michigan to approve civil rights protections for gay, lesbian, bi, trans, and queer people. Today, two backers on what they intend and how their proposal might do on a 2020 ballot. Also on the show, talks over the state's public mental health system reach a stalemate.
We want to go out. We need to listen, and we know that from listening, we're going to come up with a better, stronger plan.
We speak with Michigan's Chief of Human Services about where we go from here. And an Instagram star raised in Detroit pulls back the curtain on coming of age full of secrets.
You can't really be who you want to be being visibly fat, being visibly black, and being visibly Muslim. So how can we kind of hide these things and not really talk about it?
Leah Vernon shares stories from her memoir, Unashamed. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, the state looks for public input on improving the mental health system. We're going to talk with the head of Health and Human Services about designing the system for the people who need it. But first, Michigan's 2020 ballot may include a proposal to protect gay, lesbian, trans, and queer people from discrimination. The Fair and Equal Michigan campaign has submitted language to a state board. If that proposed language is approved, the campaign can start gathering signatures to get the issue on the table in Lansing. With us today are two members of the Campaign Leadership Committee. Selma Tucker is a vice president at Public Sector Consultants in Lansing. Selma, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, April. Good to be here.
And also with us, Dr. Joe Schwartz, former Republican congressman from Battle Creek. Dr. Schwartz, good to have you.
Thanks very much. Nice to be with you.
Selma, can I start with a question to you? Why is the corporate community interested in this issue?
The corporate community is interested in this issue because it's just sort of basic housekeeping. These are folks who are really concerned with making sure that we can attract top talent and making sure that we can retain the talent that we have. We are operating in a fairly tight job market, which makes these things really evident for employers and people who are seeking jobs, that people need to be able to go to work without fear of reprisal. They need to be able to go to work to know that they can show up and do their job, and they can collect the earnings that they have that they've contributed to, and they can do that without fear of retribution because of who they love and how they spend their personal life.
It's been decades since a proposal of this kind got some serious consideration from lawmakers or voters. Why now?
Well, why now? Why now is a really good question. It's been 37 years, I understand, 37 years since this was first introduced. And as I understand, it was actually introduced by someone by the name of Jim Dressel, who was a West Michigan Republican, some 37 years ago, and said, our Civil Rights Act should also include sexual orientation. And some 37 years later, I'm 33 years old, and the Michigan citizens have been patiently waiting for this to finally manifest and show itself in our statute. So now is the time to do it, because justice delayed is justice denied. And in order to make sure that our community feels as whole as possible and we are treating people equally and fairly, these are protections that need to be extended to the LGBT community.
Joe Schwartz, the proposal would expand the Elliott-Larsen Civil Rights Act. Now, right now, the language of that act prohibits discrimination on the basis of religion, race, color, national origin, age, sex, height, weight, familial status, or marital status. How should that language be changed?
How should it be changed? Well, you read the list. You read the shopping list for the original Elliott-Larsen Act from 1973 from Representative Daisy Elliott, a Democrat from Detroit, and Representative Mel Larson, who I believe was from Oxford in Oakland County. We have to bring it up to the 21st century. We have to do what is right. This is a no-brainer. LGBTQ people, LGBTQ as a category, should be included in the Elliott-Larsen Civil Rights Act. And just as was just stated, we cannot have any discrimination on that basis in the workplace. And I believe this would cover that issue as well as statute can cover anything, and it should go through the legislature. I fear maybe there'll be some problems, and it will have to go before the people. And if it does, the people should vote very, very strongly in favor of it.
Right. If there are several ifs on the table right now, if the proposed language gets approved, if enough signatures are gathered, and, you know, then there is that possibility of either lawmakers in Lansing dealing with this or a referral to the ballot. Joe, if it does go to the legislature, how certain are you that a body under Republican control would support it? Michigan's Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey is not a fan.
I'm not certain at all. They may not. They may not. That's why they're doing a petition drive. I don't believe they'll have a whole lot of problems collecting the 340,000-odd signatures. And if the legislature decides not to take it up and pass it, which then would make it law, and they would not have to go to the people, there will have to be a referendum. And there very well may be in November of 2020. And I believe if there is, it will pass. I would hope that the members of the legislature who might have opposed this before would examine their conscience and understand that this is the right thing to do and it simply should be done. Remember, Governor Snyder did something very similar vis-a-vis state bureaus and departments and employees just prior to his leaving office, but it covered only state employees.
I do wonder how much the political and social climate of Lansing has changed. Selma, you're a gay man. You live and work in the political world of the state. Do you think there's been enough change in Lansing that this ballot initiative would get a majority?
Well, I don't know if there's been enough change in Lansing, but I can tell you that in Michigan, the changes in hearts and minds in this state have been really remarkable. I'm doing this from a personal standpoint. My company, even though I work in a policy world, and I work in Lansing, and it's a nonpartisan shop, I'm fortunate to go to a company every day, to go to an organization every single day that that wants me to show up and do good work for them and do good work for my clients, and that is what they're most concerned about. But that could all change tomorrow. That could change in a heartbeat if my employer, for whatever reason, said that, you know, they didn't like the fact that I happen to be in love with another man. That then they'd say, hey, you know what, we don't want you working here anymore. And I think that when you talk to Michiganders and you ask them, is it okay if people go to work every day and are doing a fine job and are doing what they need to do, should it be okay to fire them because of who they love? And I think most Michiganders would say no, which is why the polling for this is so incredibly strong. And people go on a journey. You know, this whole country has been on a journey. But I think this matter is pretty well solidified in the hearts and mind of Michiganders. And if Lansing isn't ready, I'm pretty sure the state of Michigan is.
Tell me about some of the people who've joined in the coalition to get behind the fundraising, to get the ballot, to get the signature gathering off the ground.
Sure. It is a diverse body of people that includes someone like me, a gay black man from West Michigan who works in Lansing. And you've got Representative Schwartz on the phone with us here today, a West Michigan Republican as well. These are things that cross boundaries, and they cross our political lines because they are inherently personal. And, you know, folks have to search their conscience and they have to search their heart and ask themselves, is it okay that our law permits someone to say evict you because you are transgender, to say, you know what, I don't want you living in this house anymore. If I'm your landlord, I don't want you living in this house anymore because I disagree with who you love. I don't think that anybody who's hearing this conversation, most people hear that and say that's not okay, and they might be surprised to know that it's perfectly legal in the state of Michigan. And those anyone who is interested in correcting that wrong, and bringing in extending those protections so that they are fair and they are equal with everyone else. I think that those are the people who have signed up, and that's why you're seeing the business community come out so strongly. You see Priority Health, you see Consumers Energy, you see DTE Energy, you see Herman Miller. You see a great cross-section of our titans of industry and our small businesses who are saying, guys, we just got to get this done. It's about time. It's good housekeeping. We're a modern state, and this one's fruit on the ground.
Let's suppose for a minute that this ends up on the ballot in front of voters next year. There certainly have been times when anti-gay ballot proposals have drawn in a certain kind of voter or a certain kind of primary voter. I'm curious to know how something like this might affect the larger ecosystem of what's on the front burner for elections this year.
The ballot proposals in Michigan are way down ballot, as you know.
Right.
They're pretty much at the end of the ballot. So people first are going to have to be interested enough in the issue to get there when they vote. And that doesn't always happen. There's a fall off between the top of the ballot and the bottom of the ballot. But I think this is a good issue, and I believe a great majority of Michiganders will do the right thing. And the time has come to do the right thing, and LGBTQ people should be included in the Elliott Larson Act. It's as simple as that. And to try to parse it and to make it more complicated than that gets us somewhere in left field where we don't need to be. It should be a part of Elliott Larson. We will have the opportunity, I'm quite certain, in November to vote on that issue. And I just hold as a consummation devoutly to be wished that the legislature would save us having to have it on the ballot in the fall, but I'm not in any way certain that that will happen.
These days, we're much less likely to hear outright opposition to gay rights and much more likely to hear arguments surrounding conservative voters' religious beliefs that expanded civil rights for LGBTQ folks might constitute an infringement for people who believe that humans are meant to be exclusively heterosexual.
They will do that, but that's nonsense. It will not.
Thank you.
It's very clear that it will not. But that will be an argument that's brought up. If you run out of logical arguments in opposition, you come up with illogical arguments in opposition, and that is an illogical argument.
Joe Schwartz, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
And Selma Tucker, thanks to you as well.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Selma Tucker, Vice President at Public Sector Consultants, and Joe Schwartz, a former Republican congressman from Battle Creek. We'll continue to follow this topic all through the season. After the break, homework. Love it or hate it, it's a staple of American education, but some teachers and students are questioning its usefulness. Parents, sit down for this one. Is it time to ditch homework? That's coming up on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. There are many ways to describe what it's like to experience life with chronic mental illness. For a lot of people, it's a seemingly endless cycle of battles with insurance companies, ER visits, or quite simply, going without treatment. Today, Michigan's Department of Health and Human Services begins a series of five public listening sessions as part of a long conversation about improving the mental health system. One crucial goal over the last few years has been to better integrate physical and behavioral health care. Earlier today, I spoke with Robert Gordon, the department's director, and he says that it's critical the state get its hands around mental health costs.
One of the great opportunities from integrated care is to actually increase our level of investment in addressing people's mental health needs. That one of the funny things is that take a person who has severe depression and they have diabetes. If their depression goes untreated, there's a very high likelihood that their diabetes is also not going to be well treated. And then they're going to end up in the emergency room. And everybody's going to pay for that. And if we invest more in getting them the mental health care that they need so that they are addressing their depression, chances are much greater that they will be able to better care for their diabetes. They will be more content in their lives. They will be in better physical health. and even taxpayers will be better off. And we think the changes that we are talking about facilitate that kind of upfront investment in mental health. We are strongly committed to doing everything we can to increase investment in mental health care. And we know that if we invest effectively in mental health care, it's going to pay off. It's going to pay off most importantly in human terms, but even if you're just counting dollars and cents, it's also going to pay off.
The state has been involved in a fairly lengthy conversation about how this system of care could become much more integrated. How do you describe where the process stands right now?
So I think we're at a key moment. There have been years of conversation and years of effort and, candidly, years of argument about these issues. And we think we're in a position to learn from those conversations and to move forward with a path that builds on what is best and strongest in Michigan's mental health care, but also addresses the challenges that we have. So we think it's a key moment of opportunity for the state.
What would you say you've learned to this point?
We've learned that people want to be treated as integrated human beings. People need greater access to care. They want more choices. And people want less paperwork. They want less complexity. They want more simplicity. I think those are the biggest things we're trying to solve for.
What's your goal for the listening sessions that begin today?
We are acutely aware that while we have ideas, we do not have all the answers, and that the way to learn is to listen. And in particular, it's to listen to individuals who have experience in our system, who have experienced the challenges of not being able to find doctors, of struggling with insurance companies, of struggling with paperwork, of having doctors who aren't connected with each other. So we want to go out. We need to listen. And we know that from listening, we're going to come up with a better, stronger plan.
Now, the health plans that are DHHS's partners in providing care have been aggressively lobbying for years to get more of a hand in the state's Medicaid mental health system. It's a $2.4 billion system, not a small proposition to take on. The health plans argue that they can do it more efficiently and effectively than the state. What is your view right now on whether that should happen?
We're going to take a different approach than the plans have talked about. The principles that we are talking about are, first, to build on the strong public safety net that we have in Michigan today. Michigan has and can be proud to have a strong public community-based system of mental health care, and we want to build on that. We want there to be a strong publicly-based option for folks. At the same time, we want people to have choices, and we think that the health plans can be involved in giving people choices. But we really want to anchor in and begin with building on that strong public system.
With that in mind, for the care side of it, what role do you see the health plans taking?
We're talking about a model. It's a model that other states have used. It's called a specialty integrated plan. And what you can think about it as that health plan that has the expertise and the knowledge that come from being a mental health provider, but also have some of the functions and the kind of organizational skills of an insurance plan. So you bring those two skill sets together in one entity, and we think that that kind of entity could be led by public health providers and should be led by public health providers, but also could be led by a health plan, or it could be led by hospitals. There's lots of options. We think there are great opportunities for Michigan to have partnerships that are built from leaders in the community, from folks who do this, who have it in their blood, and that through that ground-based expertise, we can get people the care that they need.
Is that something that the health plans are ready to embrace?
We've had really good conversations with the health plans. We've had really good conversations with the leaders of the public system. We've had really good conversations with advocates. And we think we have an approach that that brings everyone to the table and really builds on what is best in our system today.
The system right now has 10 public entities that you might say serve as hubs throughout the region in providing care. Do you think the system could or should be more streamlined?
We would like for the state to move toward statewide plans when it comes to mental health. If you think about someone's life, they may move in their life, and yet they want to maintain continuity of care. And today, if you move even a short distance, if you move from Wayne County to Oakland County, you can experience very significant disruption. And we would like to reduce that. So we think there's an opportunity to move in the direction of statewide plans that will give people more opportunity for mobility and less complexity, less paperwork, less administrative churn.
Michigan did some experiments with pilots that were set up to find the best way forward in the process that you're talking about of integrating physical care and behavioral health care to see how a public system could collaborate with the private health plans. People might know these as the Section 298 pilots. Last fall, Governor Whitmer ended them. Could you explain a little bit about what was learned and maybe what wasn't quite ideal about the 298 pilots?
Yeah. So the 298 pilots were built on the idea that you referred to earlier, that you could integrate mental health care entirely within the Medicaid health plans, within the physical health plans that we currently have. The idea of integration in 298 was an important one. And the idea of bringing people to the table and having robust conversation was also important. And we really want to honor the countless hours and not just months, but years of effort that went into the conversations about Section 298. At the same time, there's a reality that the goal and the premise of that effort was that folks could come to agreement, and they didn't. And the second thing was that the premise of that effort was that just integrating everything within the health plans was the right way to go. And in the end, we don't feel that. We think, as I talked about earlier, that it is better to create plans that really build on the strengths of behavioral health expertise that we have in the state and that are specialized for folks who have behavioral health, mental health, or substance use disorder or developmental disability challenges. So we're going in a different direction of specialized plans that are separate from the Medicaid health plans that we have today. But at the same time, we really are learning from and building on those hours and hours of conversations and actually some very distinct ideas around partnerships and conversations that began that we think that we can build on.
Once the listening sessions have been completed, what sort of timeline do you have in mind for moving into a stage where people might see some of these options coming online?
Yeah, so we do need to listen to begin with, and we don't want to rush that process. At the same time, we do feel urgency. This has been an issue that has been it has been debated for years in Michigan, and across the state, there are people who need and deserve better. They need and deserve more access to care. They need and deserve more choices. They need and deserve integrated care. And so we're going to aim to work with the legislature in 2020 to get something done. And then to be able to move forward after that to put in place a transition plan. You know, there's no point in rushing, but we want to move as quickly as we can.
Well, Director Gordon, thank you for taking some time with us today.
Thanks so much for having me. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Robert Gordon leads Michigan's Department of Health and Human Services. The first of the listening sessions happens today in Detroit. Others are scheduled Thursday in Grand Rapids, January 22nd in Marquette, and January 30th in Saginaw. There's also a virtual forum February 6th. How many hours of your life were spent at the kitchen table grinding it out under parental threat to do your homework? Some teachers are rethinking the usefulness of large amounts of homework. Matinga Ragatz comes in to talk about education matters with us. She's a Michigan educator and member of the National Teachers Hall of Fame. Matinga, nice to have you.
Nice to meet you as well.
Say it isn't so. Homework, that magical hour when parents can sit with their children in the holy communion of long division, has been questioned as less than effective?
It is not only the question, but it's the question of the hour. Why? Because there's a lot of science that comes up now that says that maybe homework is not the best and the most effective way for kids to learn. Because on one hand, there is a lot of research that says, you know, lots of homework is kind of idle hands. Lots of homework keeps the kids busy and they keep them responsible. And plus, it adds a lot of bullet points for the parents to brag about how busy their kids are in homework and as well as in
their activities and stuff.
But on the other hand, we're finding that busy work really gives the kids a lot of stress and they feel, you know, they no longer feel really respected.
There are some fun historical arguments against homework. One of our producers turned up a piece from the late 1900s addressing homework as, quoting here, a national crime at the feet of parents. I mean, how would you say teachers generally feel about homework?
It's all over the planet because some districts are mandating homework standards and some districts are not. But the important thing is how the students feel about the homework. And students actually, you know, I had a conversation with a group of students a couple of days ago, and they don't really feel like they don't need homework. In other words, they are not anti-homework. They just have they made it very specific. There are two types of homework. There's the homework that makes me feel like I'm really working, like developing my skills. And there's the homework that is just busy work. So it's not a question of whether or not we should do homework. It's a question of whether the homework is actually valuable to the learning process. And teachers are starting to see that not all homework is the same.
It feels like so much of the conversation gets roped into our ideas about self-discipline and the ability of students to, you know, take control over their educations. I mean, there are places in the world where the school day is much shorter and there is more work done in the home that is essentially schoolwork. But that's not really how we function here.
Absolutely not. I mean, if you take the word homework and you divide it into home and work, you are basically assuming that this child has a home, not just a house, a home to go to that supports the homework structure. Somebody, like you said, you're sitting at the kitchen table, you know, having an argument over lung division. Not very many kids, especially in a dual salary home where somebody has to work, have that environment. So as we're becoming more aware of the inequities that homework can build, teachers are starting to think like, well, I'm not sure what kind of home this child is going to, so let me make sure that the homework that he does or the work that he does is the homework that I can see.
What are the ways to help out students who may not have the home resource supporting a homework culture in that way?
Well, for one, we have to completely and absolutely rethink the way that we think about homework. Right now, homework is either, well, you didn't finish your homework, your work in school, so take it home, or listen, do this, this assignment so that you can be ready for tomorrow. However, not only do teachers have to change their homework practices, but they have to change also their classroom practices. So the practice is more about the learning and the development of the child rather than in the minutia, like worksheets and the repetition. Because a child will tell you, if I understand the math problem, by problem number 3, why do I have to do 20 problems? So now the teacher's telling you, well, my grade book has to look a certain way. So we really have to rethink the purpose of the homework.
Well, what's an example of a different approach to homework?
Okay, so this happened to me just this past week. I had a bunch of 12-year-olds who were learning the research process. And so they were allowed to choose a topic that was interesting to them. So when the assignment was delivered, we thought the kids were going to do things like, oh, maybe cafeteria food or friendship. No. These kids came up with things like depression and anxiety and peer pressure and things
seriously
like that.
Seriously heavy issues.
Very, very heavy issues. And so now they were never given homework, but they were learning the research process. And these kids went home and did so much more research because they were really, really interested in the topic.
There are probably a lot of people listening to this who grew up in the era of pretty strict homework time. Is there an alternative for parents who might feel a little left out of their kids' homework loop?
For sure. There are tons of alternatives now, especially when parents are thinking that, you know, homework is basically hijacked the relationship between the parent and child. You get a lot of conversation about your schoolwork and very little conversation about what is your mental health, right? So one of the recommendations that I have for parents is to really plug into what the schools are doing. The schools are doing, you know, they're trying to onboard parents, but parents cannot always come. So I'm suggesting that either you find a surrogate if you cannot come or go into the school social media. principals, secretaries, teachers are all posting on Twitter. They have learning management systems. They have they're writing blogs. And so if you can post your latest vacation on Facebook, you have enough time to go into your child's Google Classroom and see what he has to do.
I've noticed just in my very brief history with Ann Arbor Public Schools, there's a little bit more suggestion that apps can play a part in the at-home learning process, too. Here's an app you can do with your kids to help them practice their Spanish or work on their math drills.
For sure. And not just that, but the apps have it gives the students also a sense of autonomy. You don't need that parent as a lookout. You know, the teacher can see the work that you're doing at home with their app.
We're coming at this as if homework is necessarily the dragon of every school kid. That's not necessarily the case. There are kids who ask for extra homework. What are the possibilities for them?
I mean, think about homework like a sports practice. So homework is practice. And some kids will stay at the gym longer and practice their jump shot. And some kids will go, I got it the first time. So if we, again, assign things that allow the child to feel like, you know, if I do this homework, I'm going to improve a skill rather than just, you know, beyond multiplication. I think that the kids that like to do homework will do homework and they can knock themselves out. And the kids that don't like that homework or don't have the access to homework can also succeed in the classroom.
Matinga, thank you so much for looking at this for us and coming in to talk.
April, thank you.
Matinga Ragatz talks to us about education regularly on Stateside. Last night at Little Caesars Arena, a technical malfunction transformed into a statement of brotherly love between Americans and Canadians. As longtime Detroit anthem singer Karen Newman performed O Canada, her mic dropped out, but Detroit fans did not miss a beat and finished the song for her. You guys, awesome job, seriously. The Detroit Red Wings went on to get a much-needed win over the visiting Montreal Canadiens, 4-3. Coming up, we talk to Detroit native Leah Vernon about her new memoir, Unashamed. You're listening to Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. We like to believe that the internet has something for everyone, that the constraints and the hang-ups of the real world just melt away as we're out there online finding our communities. But growing up in Detroit, model and style blogger Leah Vernon did not see much reflecting her own experience. Last year, she published a memoir called Unashamed, Musings of a Fat Black Muslim. It's a story of how she learned to override people's expectations, both in real life and online, and find her path to Instagram stardom. Leah Vernon, welcome to Stateside.
Hey, thank you for having me. I'm excited, a little scared.
There is nothing for the unashamed woman to be afraid of here. You start the book by saying, where I come from, women hide things.
Yes.
Why is that important to understand?
I think that's important to understand because a lot of my life, just personally, I have hidden things, especially there's a part in the book about my secret abortion at 19. And I had that for at least a good decade before I actually started talking about it openly. And the fact that was like eating me up inside, where I felt like I couldn't tell anyone, where I couldn't be unashamed about my decision. When I was finally able to say it out loud, so much weight was like released from me. And so I think it's important for people to be able to share their truths and not be ashamed about it, not hide it, because it's just so much weight to carry when we hide things. And I know a lot of marginalized women and individuals, we hide so much.
There have been a couple of memoirs that have addressed this lately. I was thinking of Kiese Layman's Heavy, where, you know, what is on one hand a contemplation of exteriors is very much an exploration of interiors. It's it must have been a very daunting subject to approach in writing.
Yeah, it's really interesting because, like, I never set out to be a memoirist, or I never set out to
have my life broadcasted on the internet or in a book. I started out as a fiction writer. I always wrote like YA dystopian and like multicultural sci-fi, where I could kind of like live vicariously through these characters who were open and strong and all these things, something I can never do in real life. And so it's really interesting how I kind of shared something small on the internet when I first started blogging, and people were like, oh my God, we want to know more. And it just kind of snowballed into me giving a little bit more and being more comfortable, having other women who look nothing like me, believe nothing in what I do, be like, hey, like, I'm not a fat Black Muslim woman, but I have had an abortion, or I've went through a divorce, or I went through a messy period. And it's so amazing how like universal storytelling and narrative have become.
You paint evocative pictures of growing up in Detroit in the book. That's sort of the first few chapters. And you talk about how you and your brothers and sisters were brought up, and you were homeschooled and brought up Muslim, of course. Your early childhood sounds strict and riddled by, you know, problems that your mom was having with the men in her life, but also very fun in some ways.
Yes.
Can you talk about what you remember from those years and what it was like writing about them?
I think a lot of times, especially like with me talking about like my childhood and stuff like that, some people have been very aggressive with some of the reviews about my mother. And just for the record, like, my mother did the best she could with what she had. It wasn't easy raising all the children she had with no help from any of the fathers. And it was hard writing some of the moments, because as an adult, you really are like, sometimes we forget the things that kind of shape us. And so me having to recall some of the stories about like my father like fat shaming me, or just other situations where I felt were inappropriate, it hurt. I cried a lot writing these essays. But on the other end, it was definitely a relief to finally put them out on paper.
Well, those obstacles are a big part of the early part of your growing up story that you tell in the book. You were raised Muslim, of course. Your mom's Muslim and raised all the kids that way. Could you tell us what Islam meant to you when you were, say, a teenager?
I think that I definitely, as a teenager, it went back and forth with it. I felt like initially I was very excited to wear the hijab. I was very excited to, you know, be seen in the world as a visible Muslim woman. And then the teenage years hit, where you're just like, what's cool? What's in? I want to kind of conform like everybody else. I want to be a thin, you know, white girl with both her parents. And, you know, I want to fit into the societal norm, right? And so that really tore me up inside, where it was just like, you can't really be who you want to be being visibly fat, being visibly Black, and being visibly Muslim. So how can we kind of hide these things and not really talk about it? I was ashamed, honestly, to even say I was Muslim. And I wanted to take my hijab off many times, but I felt like I was not necessarily forced, but it would be an issue if I decided to take it off. And so you'll see, like, definitely in the essays, the evolution of me kind of fighting against the hijab and loving it, and then fighting against it, and then loving it, and not really understanding what it's about. But then that journey of identity, which we all can identify with.
There were so many difficult passages in and out of those essay chapters, talking about, you know, your struggles to get into college and to make it through college, alongside kids who had money and resources, and your figuring out your own identity as a woman, as a Muslim, and as a Black woman. What would you say kept you going during those years?
I constantly ask myself that, honestly. I always ask myself, why you and not someone else who grew up in the same exact community or environment? Why you? And I kind of go back and forth with multiple responses, some of which is, I don't know. Some of which are, I always had this drive to do more, to do something bigger and greater. And I remember always telling people, like, I think I'm going to do something amazing one day. I'm not sure what it is. It will probably be with stories, but I don't know if that's possible because of the way I look or because of the way I sound. And so
I always had that internal fire and drive in which I still carry to this day, in which I also tell baby Leah V that I appreciate you for having that despite the odds, despite the Muslim community telling you that you can't model because that's not becoming of a Muslim woman, despite your white coworkers telling you that, or the microaggressions that they show you because you are the only black manager in this field. You know, so I always had that drive, and I'm glad that I continued it. And also, I don't know, I take opportunities as they come. Although I'm a very scary person beyond popular belief, I still make the time to be like, you know what, on the other side of fear is greatness. And whatever happens, at least you could say you tried.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Leah Vernon. She grew up in Detroit and lives in New York now, and her new memoir is called Unashamed. The phenomenon that people on Instagram know as Leah V began as your marriage was ending and you decided to take this flyer on a modeling career because people were always complimenting you on your style. But how did that really go from being an idea to something that you were able to make happen?
I think, honestly, at this point, people like to hate on the social medias, and I understand that there's definitely some messed up things happening on social media right now and just media in general.
Oh, yes.
But I would not be where I am right now without Instagram. Instagram has given me a platform and a voice in which I never would have had without it. And so I always tell people everything can be good or bad, but it's what you make of it. And so I had Facebook. I was so anti-social media at the time. My friends were like, you need to get an Instagram. And I'm just like, I don't have time for any more than Facebook. I'm in school. I go to work. I don't have time for these social medias. And they were like, girl, it's so much drama on there. I'm like, drama? I like a little mess. And so I basically made an Instagram page, and I stumbled upon hashtags. And one of them was plus size model. And I'm just like, oh my God, she has big boobs, big hips, living her best life, getting flown out. They are beautiful. They are thriving. And I've never seen that before. And I'm like, I can do this too. And it went from the idea of seeing other fat, curvy, plus size, whatever you want to call them, women and individuals in the industry thriving. And I'm just like, there are no fat black Muslims in the game. So let me just use my grainy Android phone, start posting pictures. And people were like, oh my God, I've never seen this before. Like, I've not. And we went and just blew up from there.
Will you tell us a little bit about the evolution of your looks?
Oh, Lord.
I mean, were you probably doing a lot of your own styling in the early stages.
I was. No, I still do a lot of my. People think that I have like this whole team behind me, and I have all these people just at my, you know, beck and call. And it's like, I do a lot of stuff alone and by myself, and it still looks like, you know, Vogue magazine level. But yeah, I definitely style myself still, and because I have a very distinct style. I like boldness, color, neons, all of that. And so it's definitely evolved. I actually won't let anyone use any photos before 2016-17-ish because I definitely had my choices of styles, and I wouldn't necessarily condone them right now. But I definitely give, you know, younger Leah V a pat on the back for making for being brave in those choices.
Your portfolio of hijab is just nothing short of stunning, both in terms of color and variety. How do you approach what you're going to do with each different thing that you're wearing?
Well, I draw inspiration from drag queens. I really, really love them, all of them. And just the fact that they have the feathers and the sequins and the contour and all the glam that comes with it. I'm in love with drag queens. And so I would be like, okay, this drag queen had this cut crease or this sequins gown. I need to like do something like this. But in my own, you know, Leah V, and so make it like, you know, my own style. But I definitely take inspirations from art and different eras, like the Victorian era, or I'll take some African print and like add that to something. But all the clothes or styles that I do have to make me feel like I am a queen. Like, I need to feel as if a millennial queen will wear something like this. I want it to feel regal and just like, I want it to be a conversation piece. When people look at me, I want them to be like, oh my God, like, who is she and what does she have on and what is the inspiration behind it?
I thought one of the most fabulous essays in the book was your essay on dating and coming to dating as a full-grown adult post-divorce, like that was really the first time you were out there playing the field. It was really the way you wrote about it was very funny and very frank, but at the same time, just, you know, I could feel you feeling your own power. What was the biggest surprise to you when you got back out there?
Dating. It's a situation.
An ongoing situation.
It's always never ending. And it's really interesting. And I think a lot of listeners will probably agree with this. But when you go from whether you've been married for someone to a minute and or had a long-term partnership with someone and you just don't have that person anymore, it's like, wow, what do I do here? And I feel like I went through a good 6 months of straight messiness because, like, remember, I got married at 19 and I got divorced like 28, 29-ish. And so that's like a whole decade. And to go from, you know, little baby to like now I'm grown and I have like a business to now I am trying to fill a void with men. And that's what I did. And I definitely added that in the book because I think that people need to understand that you're broken once you get divorced from and you're in a long-term situation. And I was, searching for individuals to fill a void that they were never going to possibly fill. And so I actually, after, you know, being messy, being in these streets for a couple of months, I'm like, this is not you and this is not helping. So you probably need to calm down and stop everything and focus on healing. And so I've actually not really dated a lot now. I'm just focusing on my work. Recently, I actually did go on one little date, and my friends were like, oh my God, Leah, you went on an actual date? I'm like, I know. Are you proud of me? Because like people know I don't date. And it's very interesting now that there's a lot of different dynamics with me dating and me being a Muslim and dating. And people are like, oh, I don't think I should talk to you because you're Muslim. I'm like, no, I'm a human being. I still want to date people. And it's a very interesting dynamic being a plus size Muslim social media influencer who is dating. It's very interesting. I need to have like a book just about that alone.
So this book published in 2019, and it was really an amazing year in a lot of ways. 2019 was also the year that the world figured out the divinity of Lizzo.
Oh, yeah.
And it was also the same year that a show based on Lindy West's memoir, Notes from a Fat Woman, hit Hulu. Mm-hmm. And it's the same year that Rashida Tlaib got sworn into Congress.
Yeah.
What would you like for 2020?
Well, it's... how can we top that? Like, how can we possibly top all of those amazing baddies? And yeah, I think that what I would want to see, because I do a lot of back end work and I'm on set with like sometimes a lot of straight size people. And it's sometimes you'll see the front end being inclusive, but not necessarily the back end. So I would want to see more back end inclusion. So more like photographers, more stylists, more marketing people, not just having a token on the set and then everyone else on, you know, behind the scenes is white making decisions about inclusion. And so I would love to see more of that. I would love to see more marginalized bodies, whether that means queer, whether that means Muslim, dark skin, whether that means you are in a wheelchair or you use assistive devices. I want to see more of that in mainstream commercials and high fashion and beauty. We've seen some of it now, but there can be so much more. Like, for instance, I went on the casting call for a well-known beauty company. I wasn't chosen, but in the room of 30 girls, I was the only Muslim, the only fat girl, and the only, black girl. Mm. And I was like, okay, wow. So this is how we're doing things. And so
the concern is they checked all the boxes with one person.
Yeah, but they didn't end up like hiring me. So it's like, you guys are, I see you guys going in the right direction, but are we really going all the way and yeah, really showing that, you know, we want to be inclusive as a company in the front and in the back end of the business. And so I'd love to see more voices put on pedestals, more voices just in front, like as the main, not just like, oh, I'm a sidekick. Like, no, I want to see like the main faces of marginalized individuals.
So Leah Vernon, what's next?
Well, right now we are looking into doing more events and tours next year, beginning in January, hopefully. I'm looking to do more modeling gigs, more like high level magazine things. I am trying to get signed to an international agency, and I have some other big projects coming up, but I don't think I'm at liberty to say right now about that. But it's going to be really huge. I think people are going to be like, oh my God, like I am dead. And the last thing is that I'm working on book number two.
Oh, awesome.
And it probably won't be a memoir.
are we going to get your science fiction book finally?
I think so. Yeah, I'm working on it. And so I'm a little scared. People are going to be like, oh, this is way off. But I'm like, I was writing this before, guys. So I am working on that now. I think it's a great story, and I think that people are going to really, it's going to resonate with people.
That's awesome. This book that's on shelves right now is Unashamed, Musings of a Fat Black Muslim. The author is Leah Vernon. You can find her on Instagram as LVernon2000, Leah V. Leah Vernon, thank you so much for the book and for your beautiful feed. It's just, it's gorgeous.
Thank you so much.
Just a quick note, if you were with us yesterday for the show, during our conversation with Elections Director Jonathan Brader, we misidentified Michigan's 2018 Independent Redistricting Commission proposal. It was, in fact, Prop 2. Michigan Radio regrets the error, and thanks, Connie, for pointing it out. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.
Thank you so much.
Just a quick note, if you were with us yesterday for the show, during our conversation with Elections Director Jonathan Brader, we misidentified Michigan's 2018 Independent Redistricting Commission proposal. It was, in fact, Prop 2. Michigan Radio regrets the error, and thanks, Connie, for pointing it out. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.